It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn more about a new music festival coming to Eau Claire this summer featuring acts like The National and Bon Iver.
First, we're getting the latest about the protests and demonstrations planned today in response to the police shooting of an unarmed biracial man, Tony Robinson, last Friday night in Madison.
There have been lots of protests, demonstrations, community meetings since Robinson's death Friday night. Today, there was a student walkout scheduled at 1:30. Students were planning to meet at the Department of Corrections building for a rally at 3 to protest what they call the school-to-prison pipeline. Tonight at 5, supporters of the Madison Police Department planning to rally at the Wisconsin Law Enforcement Memorial on the Capitol Square. Mary Spacuzza is on the scene. She joins us now. She's a politics and breaking news reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us about this latest protest ongoing now, I imagine? What happened today?
There were about 3 buses that left from Madison West that were transported over to a park right by Department of Correction, and they met with other supporters of Tony Robinson and his family. Actually, his mother and uncle both spoke to protesters. The uncle talked about Black Lives Matter and their concerns about people being targeted. They did stress that they are not anti-police. And his mother, Andrea Irwin, again, she thanked people for their support, and she repeated that she does not want any violence done in his name. The protests have been peaceful so far. There was, a lot of chanting and drumming, but people have been peaceful.
And so people can picture this. Where is this Department of Corrections building?
It's over on East Washington. So some people did march over. Some people took buses. They gathered in the park and talked beforehand, and then it was really a short march to the Department of Correction. It was only about a block from where they were. However, they are going to be marching to some other locations, and it sounds like they could be out there for a while before they get to their final destination.
So this was not in the shadow of the Capitol, as many of the protests have been. Is this something where streets are being closed down?
We haven't seen any, major streets closed so far. They were really on the sidewalk, so we did not see any East Washington being shut down like we did on Monday when the East High students and O'Keefe Middle Schools marched.
Now, apart from the shooting of Tony Robinson, was this more widely focused on other prison issues than some of the previous protests?
It was. His family remained focused on him. They talked about his memorial. They're planning to, his funeral is going to begin at 2 p.m. on Saturday. So they talked about that. There were, however, there was talk about, the correction system. There was talk about job opportunities. And so there are other, other causes being brought up. And as you mentioned, the kind of school to prison pipeline that some people have been talking about in recent days.
Now, following your Twitter feed, I know you've been covering some of what the governor has had to say. He met with a Madison activist, organizer. What has he weighed in on when it comes to all these issues?
He met with Michael Johnson from the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County and another representative from that organization today. In his statement, the governor said that he felt great empathy for the Robinson family. He and his wife expressed their condolences. He said that today they talked quite a bit about working together to increase opportunities for young people. Michael Johnson said that included talk about education and about jobs.
And there's another rally scheduled today at 5, I believe. Supporters of the Madison Police Department, I was looking at their Facebook page, they're not building this as a protest, but a rally in support of officers. What do we know about this rally?
No, I am going to be heading there very soon, and I'll have a little bit more information. I don't know how big it's going to be, how many people will be there. It's interesting because the Robinson family, although there have been some anti-police chants, they have been consistently very, very positive about police, saying that law enforcement is necessary and that they don't want people to be anti-police, and that is not the message the family is trying to spread. So it'll be interesting to hear what the pro-police protesters have to say and how that message is different than what the family's been saying. But certainly some of the protest chants have been anti-police and, arrest the police, things like that. So we'll see in about 45 minutes.
Now, you've been following protests since the weekend and into today. Have you seen the mood, the stance of participants changing in this 5-day span?
You know, I think people have, there's been anger and there's been frustration, and certainly people feeling like something is wrong with the criminal justice system. I wouldn't say that I've seen, you know, tensions flaring to the point of anger, to the point of violence at any point. And I think people have been kind of angry but peaceful, I would say.
And what was the police role like at the protest today?
There was a police presence today, but from everything I saw, police were very much on the sideline monitoring. I saw actually a police officer hug a protester. I saw some conversations between people. I did not see anything even remotely confrontational. There was not a huge police presence. It wasn't like dozens of officers. They were there, but really pretty much just off to the side and only seeming to interact with people who wanted to interact with them.
Now, there's this rally in support of police this afternoon. Have you heard about what's coming next from government officials, protest organizers, or others for the remainder of the week and beyond that?
I think it sounds like more protests are being planned. I think the family is focused on the funeral arrangements, but I would not be surprised if protests continue throughout the week and into the weekend.
Mary, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Mary Spicuzza, politics and breaking news reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, with us to talk about the rallies scheduled today in response to the police shooting of Tony Robinson last Friday.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll be talking about this summer's newest music festival, which will bring nationally acclaimed music to western Wisconsin.
But now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Long after the snow melts, the snowshoes stay out and in use in Lake Tomahawk. For more than 50 years, snowshoe baseball has attracted crowds to weekly games. Brianne Shasa went to see the sawdust fly in the snowshoe baseball capital of the world.
They're good ball players, but they're not used to playing on snowshoes. But we're happy to have you here. Nice to see the crowd. I always say a prayer to the man upstairs that we can get the game in, and you can enjoy the evening.
Meet Don Hilgendorf. He's coached the Lake Tomahawk Snowhawks for 16 years, and last season was his final one as coach. While the sky above him looks like it could break open and start to rain at any minute, that's hardly going to stop snowshoe baseball. It's a tradition in this town.
This snowshoe baseball in the summertime right now has been going on for 53 years. It started in 61, so we're the home team all the time. All the people come to see the Snowhawks. They want to see who's going to beat them tonight, or can anybody beat them tonight. it's a good following. But we've had great games. We've had all-star teams out of Chicago up here play every year. We've had real good competition.
In 1961, town chairman Ray Sloan wanted residents and summer tourists to have something fun to do, so he invited other area teams to challenge hometown players to games in the summer and replace the usual snow-covered field with sawdust. But it isn't just about the game of snowshoe baseball, complete with its snowshoes and larger ball. Community plays a huge role in this event. When I called Coach Hilgendorf about coming to see a game, he suggested I drive up as early as I could so I wouldn't miss out on the pie. When I say pie, I mean dozens of pies. Crimped, baked, and donated by community members every week.
My name is Mary Ellen Mazurczak, and I live in the town of Lake Tomahawk. And every Monday evening, there's a different service club that runs the concession stand. And our claim to fame for a long time has been the homemade pies. We usually always sell out. And we get some interesting varieties because we, you know, people, they pick berries, they go and get strawberries, they do rhubarb, they make, you know, their own lemon meringue. So we never really know what we're going to get.
The community also helps raise funds to keep the sawdust-covered field and its surroundings in tip-top shape, raising money for new lights, a press box, and more. They're currently trying to replace the bleachers.
Root, root for the Snowhawks. If they don't win, it's a shame.
Now, snowshoe baseball is a popular sport. It's drawn attention from the Travel Channel and, of course, fans from the area and around the world. And last year, the Wounded Warriors softball team traveled to Lake Tomahawk to play against the Snowhawks. Even with the chance of rain at the game I attended, people still turned out.
We always packed the stands, and we got chairs going down both sides. So, yeah, 1,200 to 1,400 people is nothing for Monday night here anymore. The surrounding area here is only 1,200 people, period. And we have 1,400 sitting at the ballpark.
At the game, while following raffle ticket sellers around, watching players shuffle in their snowshoes around the bases, and eating a spectacular piece of a frozen strawberry pie, I couldn't help but feel at home.
This is the only place in the country you're going to find it is right here. And then people come up to see it. I always tell them, even people in Minocqua that only live 7 miles from here and haven't been here, and they feel ashamed like they haven't been here, I says, I'll tell you one thing, and you tell me if I'm wrong. You come over to see the game one time, I'll guarantee you'll come back.
He's right. I'll be back. And next time, I want to strap on a pair of snowshoes.
Catch more sports and games all this month on Wisconsin Life.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Eau Claire's Justin Vernon has toured the world and released critically acclaimed albums with his band Bon Iver, collaborated with Kanye West, and picked up a Grammy along the way, all while keeping his roots firmly anchored in Wisconsin. This summer, he's throwing his own music festival in his hometown.
The festival is called Eau Claire, with an old-fashioned spelling of the town's name, and it's going to feature a lineup of regional artists alongside national headliners like Spoon, the Indigo Girls, and the National for a two-day multi-stage festival in July.
Joining us now to tell us more about the event is musician, author, and the festival's official narrator, Michael Perry. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Well, howdy. Thanks for having me.
So the question that leapt out at us here at Central Time was, what does a narrator do at a music festival?
Boy, when I find out, I'll be sure to let you know. It's evolving. It's been really interesting to be involved in this project. It's been fun to watch them pulling this together and pulling it off and announcing it, and I've had some role in writing some of the releases and announcements. But as far as the festival narrator role, I think in general my hope is that I can in some way convey what the festival is about, but also what this place is about, the Chippewa Valley.
Right, and I know that the Western Wisconsin, the Eau Claire area, it's a pretty tightly knit area. How did you get involved in the music festival?
I was asked by the folks who were putting it together and by Justin. I think one of the things I've always admired about Justin is that he credits the Chippewa Valley with supporting him and being a source of his creativity. And I'm a guy, too, who's just so benefited from living here. And I still live in the Chippewa Valley. And so I was just asked if I would be involved. And I said yes, frankly, without really knowing what was going to happen. And so far, it's just been a thrill.
Now, some music festivals tour, you know, the Lollapaloozas and Bonnaroos of the world. And then there's, you know, place-specific ones like Summerfest in Milwaukee. So how will this Eau Claire Music Festival convey that sense of place of Eau Claire and its region?
Well, for one thing, it's the very location, which is down by the Chippewa River, which is what gives this very valley its name. And then also, wherever possible, trying to have some sort of local influence on the festival. Obviously, you bring in national acts so that you get national attention. And it's been pretty overwhelming, the reaction that this has gotten nationally. And it's fun to introduce the nation to the Chippewa Valley. But as far as the hometown feel, a lot of it is just with the situation and then with vendors and food and that sort of thing that all have some sort of local connection. And this region has just given us so much. I think that's a big inspiration for Justin, is trying to give a little something back with this festival.
And the lineup seems incredibly diverse. I don't know if it's complete or not, but you've got groups like the Blind Boys of Alabama alongside a Japanese noise rock band called Melt Banana. How important is the diversity that you're going for?
Very important, and I know that I was not involved in selecting the lineup per se, although I will say I really lobbied heavily for Sturgill Simpson, a guy I really love his work, and I'm thrilled that he's on the bill. He's got that old school country sound, but with a very modern sensibility. And so I know that there's a very active intent here, and that is to have this thing be more than just music, but an experience. And that comes right down even to the design, not just how they light the stage, but how they light the grounds, and that there's an artistic experience in just walking through the place when the festival happens. And then that is reflected by this wide range of music. And one of the things I like about that, look, I'm a flat-footed country kid from Chippewa County. That's still where I'm the most comfortable. It's just being on our farm or on the back 40. But I also, my life has been so enriched and changed by artists of all stripes, be they poets or visual artists, musicians. And one of the things that I love is going from, say, the dirt track stock car races in Menominee one night, and then going up to Russ County to watch Barry Lynn do modern dance the next night. And I think sometimes we feel like we pick one genre and stick with it. And what I love about this festival is there's a chance to go from black metal to gospel to funk. We've got hip hop coming in, and just this wide range of experience, both visually and aesthetically and musically.
Well, and speaking of that diversity, in addition to some of the national out-of-town acts we mentioned, how much will there be in terms of Wisconsin bands, local bands, Midwestern artists as part of this?
I know Fox is on the bill and Field Report. Those are certainly some folks who are getting national attention and yet have ties to Wisconsin very closely. Sean Carey, obviously, who has Eau Claire, Wisconsin roots, he's playing. So it's that delicate balance of making sure that we've got some local flavor, but also a national appeal. We're also having some neighbors from Minnesota come over, too. That's fun.
I heard a rumor that it's going to be...
People in New York City are always surprised to hear that we can just drive back and forth from Wisconsin to Minnesota.
I heard a rumor that it's going to be kid-friendly. This is something that you can bring your whole family to. Is that true?
Portions of it, for sure. Some of the details are still being put together, but I do know that there are a couple of acts that are being brought in very specifically for kids, and there's also going to be a campground area where people can experience the camping, and there will be some music there as well.
We heard from a guest yesterday.
Yeah, Grandma Sparrow is one of the. Pardon me, Grandma Sparrow is one of the acts that I know is kid friendly. Hmm.
So we heard from a guest yesterday saying, you know, arts, culture, really important to the economic development of local communities. How important are arts and things like music festivals, I guess, to the cultural life of an area like Eau Claire?
Well, they are important, and the nice thing is there are already music festivals happening in the Chippewa Valley. There are other people who have gone before us and laid the groundwork and the template. I mean, the very grounds, it's the same grounds where the folks who do Country Jam, the big country music festival, same area. And so we always try to tip our cap to those folks, too. They've gone ahead, and they've already made this an area that's known for music festivals. We're just adding one that's got a little different flavor. But I just think it's one thing I enjoy about it, one thing I'm grateful to Justin and his crew for doing, for bringing this to the Chippewa Valley, is there's this idea sometimes that I run into that art belongs in certain places, whether it's the East Coast or the West Coast or big cities, and folks are sometimes surprised to think that we might have a thriving art or music scene, and I always say, man, that stuff belongs everywhere, and I'm proud that they're going to have a festival of this nature and this diversity right in our backyard. And why not? That's what I say.
Has the town of Eau Claire and the surrounding area given much thought to how it's going to absorb all these people who are coming in? You've got some really big acts coming in, not to mention Justin Vernon, Bon Iver himself as a draw. Is it something that, you know, restaurants and hotels and all those people are getting ready for?
Yes, and obviously I don't go to all those meetings. I'm out on. Matter of fact, I'm speaking to you from the road right now, having been talking this morning to a bunch of young kids in Minnesota at an arts festival. But yes, this week, for instance, the people who are organizing the festival meet with the local sheriff's department and the fire department, and you make some very serious grown-up plans before you do something like this. But also, yes, meeting with local businesses, local restaurants, you do have a big influx of people, and they need to stay somewhere, and they need to eat somewhere, and I would hope that it would be a very positive thing economically.
Michael, I know we've got a few months to figure it out, but who is on your must-see list for when this festival happens?
Well, definitely Sturgill Simpson, and I want to see the Blind Boys of Alabama. I had the great privilege of writing liner notes for one of their recent albums, an album that Justin produced, and I was able to be in the studio while they were recording, and they are just a part of the American fabric, and so I'm very much looking forward to that. And I'm looking forward to a little Melt Banana, Japanese grindcore speed metal. I have no idea what that's about, but that's going to be fun. All the more reason to look forward to it.
Anything else going on besides the music that you're looking forward to?
Yes, and a lot of this, we kind of have been telling people from the get-go to stay tuned because information comes out. The first announcement was just that there was a festival, and then the second announcement was a few of the acts, the musical acts, and then another announcement with the full lineup. And some of the, there's going to be a film component to this, there will be an art component, and as those things get finalized, the information will be released. And so, of course, in this day and age, social media is where a lot of that comes out, and so there's a website, auclair.com, spelled E-A-U-X-C-L-A-I-R-E-S, and if you go there, you can follow the Twitter, Facebook, all those social media outlets and updates.
Okay. Sounds good. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
This is Michael Perry, author and official narrator of the Eau Claire Music Festival happening July 17th in Eau Claire.
We got with one of the bands, Field Report from Milwaukee on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at the lawsuit filed over Wisconsin's new right-to-work law.
First, we're digging into a new report out about disparities in school punishment of black and white female students. Girls of color, especially black girls, are 6 times more likely to be suspended than their white classmates. To put this in perspective, African American boys are 3 times more likely to be suspended than white.
Our next guest is the author of a report taking a look at the punishment gap for girls of different races, and she's here to talk about why this racial disparity is often overlooked and what can be done to help solve the problem. Kimberly Williams-Crenshaw joins us. She's a law professor at Columbia University and UCLA. She's also the director of the Center for Intersectionality and the Social Policy Studies and the author of the report, Black Girls Matter, Pushed Out, Over-Policed, and Underprotected. Kimberly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, what did you find out about how the experience of African-American girls is different from a lot of their peers at school?
Well, there are two ways that they're different. Number one, we found that the racial disparity between black girls and white girls, namely the difference between the suspension rates for black girls and white girls, is actually greater than the disparity between black boys and white boys. It's a fact that a lot of people would be surprised about because more black boys overall are suspended than any other group. But boys generally are suspended more. When we look at girls, however, we find that black girls are suspended at rates that are 6 times the rates of white girls nationally. And then in New York and Boston, we found that black girls were suspended 10 times more often than white girls and 11 times more often in Boston. So there's just a huge disparity in the actual experience of expulsion or suspension that girls face. And then we talked to them and got more information about how they actually experience life in school to prison pipeline kind of schools.
And often when we're reading about issues of social justice or racial disparity in education and elsewhere, the focus tends to be on boys and on men. Why isn't there more attention to the race gap for women and girls?
Well, I think there are a couple reasons. Number one, the typical assumption is that race and racism is something that largely visits itself upon boys. It plays out between men and boys. People don't tend to think about racial disparity when they're thinking about women, when they're thinking about some of the things that happen to women of color and as opposed to things that happen to white women. So there's just a tendency in our culture not to really think about racial disparity when we think and talk about women. So one of the objectives of the report is to introduce introduce some of the ways that women are differentially situated, the way that race plays out between women. And I think the second reason, quite honestly, is that there are a lot of things that happen to men and boys that they're disproportionately subject to, like suspension. But there's also the reality that there are things that disproportionately happen to women of color, and we don't tend to talk about them. So we do live in a society that's shaped by race, but it's also shaped by gender. And a lot of times the things that happen to women and girls just aren't seen as significant or as critical as they should be. So one of the points of the report is to try to intervene into that and change people's conception of how important these issues are.
There's also some commonly held ideas out there that girls in general do better in school than boys, that they mature faster, they have an easier time sitting still and focusing. Does that come into play at all?
It comes into play in any number of ways. So one of the problems that some of the young women who had been suspended told us was that they many times felt that they were being punished for things that were gender non-normative. In other words, when they acted in ways that were not consistent with the stereotype, the girls sit there, you know, they're well-behaved, they're quiet, they're focused. Girls who are not just sitting, girls who are talking out in class, girls who are really active, who are seen as being too aggressive, they say that they are subject to penalties because they're not acting in the way that girls are thought to act. When you take that into account and put race into the mix, we know, you know, from some of the events that have happened lately that race tends to be associated, blackness tends to be associated with a greater level of aggressiveness. You put that on top of the idea that girls are not supposed to be aggressive, and you have a sense of some of the intersectional ways that race and gender play out as risk factors for black girls. So a lot of these assumptions about girls that tell us that we don't have to pay attention to them, it's precisely the reason why we do have to pay attention to girls, and black girls in particular, because they're subject to a whole range of stereotypes and punishment because of that.
Now, you looked at some schools and you talked with African-American girls who went there. Can you tell us a story or two about what they said?
Well, so we talked to young women at this point who had been girls who'd been steered out of school. And we wanted to get a sense of what the trajectory was, what some of the things were that led them to have difficulties in school. And we found a couple of things. One is that many of the girls said that as students, it was clear to them that these were zero-tolerance environments that were not necessarily invested in their education. So they said teachers would tell them that they were going to get paid whether they learned or not. They talked about being pushed out of school at the end of the day for being in the hall when they shouldn't be in the hall. There's just a general focus on punishment gave the message that education was not important. They also indicated that sometimes they felt that they were unfairly punished for defending themselves. So some of the girls talked about having been sexually harassed. One woman said that she responded to a boy who was harassing her. He punched her in the eye. She responded. They both got suspended. So they talk about how zero tolerance policies actually create environments in which they don't necessarily feel safe. They don't like having to go through metal detectors, taking off their clothes. They feel exposed. Some are triggered. And at the same time, the existence of these policies don't really protect them against some of the things that push them out of school. So we heard a lot of stories about what happens to girls in school that makes it difficult for them to stay attached, and suggestions for ways that some of the school policies might be better shaped to respond to girls' particular needs.
Well, one thing you're trying to tease out of this is life outcomes for these girls. If an African-American girl gets expelled, ends up in the legal system, gets funneled into a different school, what kind of effect does that have on her future?
Yeah, so some of the stories have just been absolutely, you know, jaw-dropping. One young lady in another state told us about how she was arrested for being truant, for being late to school repeatedly, and directly funneled into the juvenile justice system and wound up in solitary confinement. So it's not an exaggeration or a metaphor when we say that many of these schools have school-to-prison pipelines. They're many times direct. What we also find is just the emphasis on punishment discourages girls from attaching to school and leading many of them not to graduate. We know that when girls, particularly low-income girls of color, fail to graduate, the long-term economic consequences for them are greater than for any other group. So they're already funneled into low-wage layers in the job market. If you don't get a high school diploma, you're less likely to even get those jobs. Women, low-income women, make less than their male counterparts, so not being able to graduate means that you're going to make even less than that. So we're trying to elevate the long-term consequences of some of these school policies, both for the girls and their future social economic well-being, but also for their families. These families that most of these women will go on to lead are disproportionately families that are single-headed. So if we're looking at a single head who doesn't have the same job prospects, doesn't have the same income, doesn't have the same access to wealth, we know that the consequences are going to be shared by her and her children, both the boys and the girls. So that's one of the reasons we're trying to elevate this into the discussion about the national agenda on achievement and push out.
Now, you talked about the zero tolerance policies and how you feel that those are not effective. What are effective ways that schools can approach things that might fall under the umbrella of punishment, but maybe you don't even want to use that word?
Exactly. With some of the girls, it's clear that they're the circumstances that lead them to be disciplined are many times the effects of trauma. One young lady indicated that she had been sexually assaulted. She was not able to get effective counseling in the school or elsewhere, and eventually the trauma around that erupted, and she became a discipline problem rather than someone who had untreated trauma. So one of the things that many advocates are calling for, particularly as some of the resources are shifting away from having a heavy police presence in the school, is to use some of these resources to provide for better staffing of counseling, other forms of intervention, other ways in which girls are identified as having needs before they become statistics in a disciplinary regime. That's a big, big issue. But the girls have also said a couple things that one of the things that discourages them is when they do achieve, their achievements are not always celebrated, partly because we assume that girls are going to do well. But when girls do well and their accomplishments are not celebrated, partly because we are much more concerned about the fallout of our boys, it leads them many times to find other activities around which they will be recognized and celebrated by their peers, and those aren't activities that always lead to long-term consequences for the girls. So we know we need to have supports for them. We know that many of the girls actually have caretaking responsibilities. Some of them are their own children. Some of them are other family members. So we need to have the capacity to allow those girls who have caretaking to be able to attend school in a way that they're not punished for being late or not subject to other disciplinary consequences because sometimes they have other responsibilities.
We're talking right now with Kimberly Williams Crenshaw. She's the author of the report Black Girls Matter, Pushed Out, Overpoliced, and Underprotected.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest or maybe your experiences. If you've seen this firsthand as a student, a parent, an educator, how do you see these gaps in the way kids are disciplined play out between girls of color and white kids? Why do you think there is this kind of disparity in schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in a minute. Right now, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion with Kimberly Williams Crenshaw about her new report, Black Girls Matter, Pushed Out, Overpoliced, and Underprotected.
She finds a disparity between punishments of white girls in schools and black girls. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think might cause that? Have you seen this firsthand as a student, a teacher, or a parent? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's talk for a bit about solutions, if we can, Kimberly. You talked about helping girls to feel supported in school. What would that look like?
Well, one of the things it would look like is not punishing girls for and sending them to jail for just being late to school. That's just it was amazing to us how that came up and how many of the girls talked about that. But they also talked about just the very fact that because there have been so many moments where this social safety net has been shredded, girls actually face heavier responsibilities for their family members. They're often the caretakers of last resort. So for siblings and family members who are incarcerated, for those who have mental disorders, drug dependency, or who need interpretation or translation in dealing with government officials, there's just a lot of stress and pressure on girls that sometimes makes it difficult for them to perform in school, to actually be in school on a regular basis. So they need to be able to integrate in school and also be able to carry some of their responsibilities. But also, one of the big things that some of the women talked about was just they felt that there were a range of stereotypes that teachers held against them, and these were often teachers, some of whom who shared the same race. The idea that the girls were defiant, that they were too aggressive, that they were not proper ladies, and the job of the school was to confine and constrain them so that they would, you know, learn what some of the mores and behavioral expectations were. So we know that we need gender sensitive and culturally competent training for teachers to be able to identify and to some extent be aware of sometimes the cognitive and other kind of biases that play out against girls of color. There has been a conversation and there have been efforts to bring more men of color into the educational arena on the assumption that they will have fewer of these biases against boys of color. We haven't quite been able to think and talk about the way that, you know, some people have biases against girls of color, and that has to be addressed as urgently as some of the biases against the boys.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Yvette with us in Whitewater. Hi, Yvette.
Well, hi there. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
You know, I'm really struck by this conversation. I just want to say I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, about a half block from 8 Mile Road, and I worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken with, I was the only white girl who worked there, and I was working two jobs so I could pay for college, and I got to see some of the students that sort of you're describing firsthand as a 14-year-old, and now it's 30 years later, I'm a school teacher, and I've been teaching for 20 years. I guess when I listen to this conversation, I don't feel that I'm biased as a teacher one way or the other. I mean, we all have biases, but I guess my first concern is that what are the communities going to be doing about this? Because it seems like it's a community issue, you know, an individual community issue.
Great. I think I've got the gist of what you're saying, Yvette, and we're really short of time. I want to make sure Kimberly gets to respond to this. Thank you for your call. And Kimberly, is this a community issue? If we focus in on schools, are we only looking at a tiny portion of the picture here that actually needs to be looked at to address this? And I'm sorry, we're kind of short on time at this point.
Yeah, so I'll have to answer really quickly. Of course, it's a community issue. And part of our point is to say that we already have a dialogue that's been going on for several years about the risk factors that face boys of color. We have a national campaign called My Brother's Keeper that recognizes it's a community issue as well as a school issue. What we're simply offering information to help people think about more clearly is that it is also a community and school issue for girls. So every way in which we are thinking about putting together community resources to raise the public awareness and the public will to intervene in productive ways in the lives of boys, we also have to match those efforts with respect to girls because they are not, in fact, doing okay. And that is the most significant part of the report that we hope there's uptake on.
Well, Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Kimberly Williams-Crenshaw. She's a law professor at Columbia University and UCLA and director of the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. She was with us to talk about her new report. It's called Black Girls Matter.
The Walker administration is spelling out its case against a federal proposal to cut air pollution from coal-burning power plants and reduce the impact of climate change. As Chuck Krumbach reports, the incoming chairperson of the Public Service Commission took the EPA plan to task at a congressional hearing in Washington today.
The Obama administration's nationwide crackdown on carbon dioxide emissions from power plants could force Wisconsin to reduce its pollutants about a third by the year 2030. EPA Midwest Region Administrator Susan Hedman told a WISP Politics Forum in Milwaukee that the climate change plan is being debated as the planet is warming.
NASA and NOAA recently confirmed that 2014 ranks as the Earth's hottest year since we started keeping records in the late 1800s, and that 9 of the 10 hottest years on record have occurred since the year 2000.
Hedman says what's known as the Clean Power Plan would have many other benefits too, such as boosting energy efficiency, helping create jobs in renewable energy, and cut other pollutants that can lead to lung ailments. Governor Scott Walker is already talking about having State Attorney General Brad Schimmel file a lawsuit against the EPA, even though a final regulation won't be issued until midsummer. Public Service Commission member and incoming chairperson Ellen Nowak is a Walker appointee. Nowak told the U.S. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee today that the plan would be costly for Wisconsin consumers.
This single federal regulation will cost Wisconsin ratepayers between $3.1 billion and $13.4 billion. This is only a production cost increase. It does not include necessary upgrades to the gas and electric transmission infrastructure that will add significantly to the cost of compliance.
NOAC says the EPA's four main suggested ways to reduce CO2 emissions don't work together in practice. She says there are problems with ideas to make coal plants run more efficiently, and that the EPA isn't giving Wisconsin credit for emissions cuts already made. Todd Stewart of the Wisconsin Industrial Energy Group is a representative of big energy consumers, firms like paper and chemical companies, and other manufacturers. Stewart says by 2020, the state would have to add more natural gas-fired power plants, pipelines, and other structures.
How long does it take to site a big new power line? How about a big new power plant? How about a natural gas pipeline? How much of that can we do in a couple of years? You know, how realistic are some of these things?
Stewart also says Wisconsin would have to do more to cut carbon emissions than would be required in some other states, making it harder for Wisconsin firms to compete. Keith Riopel of the environmental group Clean Wisconsin says the proposed Clean Power Plan isn't perfect, but he says delaying action on climate change would be expensive.
There's a huge cost to some of our most important and iconic industries in the state, to the agricultural industry, to the tourism industry. There will be very large quantifiable costs from climate change and an enormous cost to public health.
Riopel also says changes to power plants would only grow more costly the longer Wisconsin would wait to reduce carbon emissions. EPA Regional Administrator Hedman says some Wisconsin firms could do very well under the proposal.
Companies that do energy efficiency work, performance contracting like Johnson Controls, you look at companies like Quad Graphics that are leaders in combined heat and power projects.
The EPA says it's received more than 4 million comments on the climate change plan. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the AFL-CIO's new lawsuit against the right-to-work law just passed and signed by the governor here in Wisconsin.
Coming up at 9 o'clock tonight, join us for the Joy Cardine Show. Today, the future of reading. In 2011, Amazon Kindle sales overtook paperback book sales. While sales of print books continue to decrease, e-books are selling better than ever. Joy Cardine speaks to a professor of linguistics who says that e-reading has both its virtues and its drawbacks.
I am still not fully embracing the e-reader world. I have a tablet. I have like an app on the tablet. But all I do is PDF news articles and stuff that I download. I still haven't read an actual book on a tablet or on an e-reader. You?
I've downloaded some books onto my phone, and I have to say it messes with my sense of accomplishment because the screen is so small. I feel like I'm not. I've read hundreds of pages. You know, I really haven't read much at all, and there's tons of pages left to go. I'm still an old-fashioned kind of gal when it comes to books.
Yeah, I tend to prefer the actual physical book. I think I will for quite a while now, though I don't know. I'm not a Luddite, so I might make the transition someday.
We'll see. The future of books remains to be seen. Well, you're listening to Central Time. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.